Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The political climate in the United States is changing. The current presidency has broken norms. Congress is not functioning as the founding fathers had envisioned. And the way Americans approach and think about politics and our political leaders has morphed. Are these changes permanent? That's exactly what the October issue of The Atlantic looked into. The issue is devoted to one single topic, a three-word question in black and white on the cover. Is democracy dying? And maybe you, our listeners, have some thoughts on that. If you do, give us a call at 212-433-9692. Joining us now is The Atlantic's editor-in-chief, Jeffrey Goldberg. Hi, Jeffrey. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm great. So here's the question. You and your team got together. I know you work with a whole bunch of smart people. How did you arrive at this question? Is democracy dying?
I don't think it takes an editorial genius to realize that right now in America, this is a question that maybe a couple of years ago we didn't think was on the table, but I think everyone can see is on the table right now. So it seemed like a kind of a big obvious question for us to tackle. The idea for doing this issue actually grew out of a single question I asked someone, a contributing editor to our magazine, Jeffrey Rosen, who's also the president of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, a great Constitution scholar, obviously. And I asked him last year, I said, so what would James Madison make of this moment in American politics? And he said, we're living inside James Madison's nightmare. And I said, whoa, that's pretty interesting. What does that mean? And he went on to explain it. We could talk about this, obviously. But for a whole bunch of reasons that have to do with Donald Trump and a whole bunch of reasons that don't have to do with Donald Trump, he was arguing that Madison's conception of indirect democracy or Republican style of government, in which, among other things, the president was not expected to even directly communicate with the American people. We're so far past that now, because of technology, because of different standards, lowered standards, because of the politicization of everything. And it seemed like that was a good James Madison was a good place to start this exploration. And then one thing led to another, and we wound up having a really intense package of stories coming at this from all different angles.
When you were putting together the issue and you worked with the contributing writers, what topics did you want to make sure were addressed?
One topic, obviously, and this goes back to this conversation with Jeff Rosen, and he wrote sort of, I guess you would call it one of the anchor pieces of this issue, James Madison versus the mob. What I wanted to understand from Jeff is, what did the founders think our democracy would look like, and what does it look like today, and what has separated us from that original vision? Let me just step back for one second and say that part of the mission here, or part of our conception of what we're doing, this is not just going to be about Trump, right? We were gonna do something that goes beyond just the particular peculiarities, which is a euphemism for something, particular peculiarities of the moment, and look at systems. So we have another piece that deals with how we've let our habits of democracy atrophy, how we've become more of an atomized society, how people
What's
don't
an example
cross
of a habit, just so people understand what you mean?
Civic habits of figuring out ways to encourage participation on small-scale democracy in your town, your school board, your village, of participating in issues that don't relate to politics or governance, but put you in touch with other Americans, other kinds of Americans. I mean, I'll tell you what underlies all of this for me is something that Jim Mattis, the current Secretary of Defense, said to me and others at various points. I asked Jim Mattis once, what worries you the most as Secretary of Defense? And, you know, you expect the Secretary of Defense to say Iran or China or Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And he said, you know what worries me more than anything is the fact that Americans have stopped liking each other. And in other words, our whole defense posture, our common economic and security future, is dependent on the idea that we're all that we all see ourselves as part of the same country, the same culture, a culture built around not creedal nationalism or race or ethnicity, but around a set of ideas, creedal nationalism. In fact, I misspoke. That we all have come to agree that we stand for a certain set of ideals that are articulated in the Constitution, Declaration of Independence. So habits of democracy are created by participation, by reaching outside your comfort zone, by engaging in various forms of civics. But we know this. I mean, this goes back to Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam, this idea that we've just become, we're separating ourselves. Those who have the means, especially, separate themselves from the larger body politic. And that can't be healthy, because when you don't know someone, it's much easier to demonize that person. This, of course, manifests itself in technology more than anything else. And if people pick up this issue of The Atlantic, they'll see that in a way, it's an issue, it's a democracy issue, but it's actually a technology issue. Because one of the big questions we have, Yuval Harari, the very famous historian, writing on the threat of artificial intelligence to the future of democracy. We have, and Jeff Rosen in this piece about James Madison, talks about what the founders would make of Twitter, this ability on the part of people to communicate all the time their hottest, most immediate emotions, rather than having built-in period structures that allow people to cool off before they express themselves. I mean, we are confronting so many different challenges at once, but underlying a lot of this is the technological ability to communicate with people we don't know immediately our most visceral opinions. And of course, when you're saying something to a group of people on Twitter, not face-to-face, a lot of people find themselves more free to express anger and emotion and disdain and contempt in ways that they wouldn't do it in a face-to-face encounter. So, I mean, as you can see by this sort of blurted out analysis of where we are, there are a million different things going on at once that are working against what a lot of people might think of as an ideal form of Republican democracy.
I want to dig into something you talked about. You talked about the habits of democracy, and one of them being interacting with all kinds of people, people who aren't like you, because of sort of a civic responsibility to be open-minded in that way. But we live in these silos now, and I think most people immediately go to the red silo and the blue silo. But partisanship has always existed. So what's the big difference now?
The big difference now, and actually we have a piece coming out in a couple of weeks about this in our next issue. One of the technology,
right?
Yeah. Well, but it's interesting because I visited the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, and I thought of it as sort of it's obviously 3,000 miles away from Silicon Valley, but I almost thought of it as sort of the doppelganger, or sort of as a kind of mirror of Facebook headquarters and Twitter headquarters. You know, the people who wrote the Constitution were pessimists about human nature, and they believed that we needed to build all kinds of structures and checks and balances into our system to prevent malicious people from rising to the fore. The techno-optimists of Silicon Valley, Facebook, Twitter, and all the rest, somehow came to the belief, we don't know how, came to believe that more communication, more immediate communication across the globe instantaneously is a good thing for humanity and a good thing for Americans. And for a long time, a lot of people sort of went along and said, yeah, they must be right, because that sounds very democratic, small d democratic. Turns out, kind of problematic. So there is that. You know, we didn't always have a party system. I mean, obviously, James Madison, those people who know this history, he was worried about two main things: the mob, not the mafia, obviously, but formations of political mobs in which reason would be suppressed by mob mentality. And he was worried, and so were the rest of the founders, by faction. Faction was their term for the rise of political parties. And what we've seen, obviously, I mean, we've gone from a period where it was considered déclassé for people to campaign for the presidency, to a point where candidates for president have to brag about their achievements, right? And talk directly to the American people. And moreover, we've moved, our politics has tended to slip, especially over the last 20, 30 years, toward a kind of hyper-partisanship. It used to be on Capitol Hill that compromise was considered a value, not only a political value, but almost a moral value, that a bunch of smart people come together and they figure out a policy solution to a dilemma facing Americans. Compromise is no longer considered a virtue in American politics. And so you have a deeply factionalized Congress, and you have the retribalization of American politics, so that it's almost impossible for people to cross party boundaries. When your party becomes your religion, it's very hard to stray from the theology of that religion. And so that's where we are. And you could, there are a million explanations for how we've reached this point. But the fact of the matter is, we are at this point. And I would say to people who are thinking about what does Trump mean in all of this, the sort of implicit argument, or I sort of stated it fairly openly in my editor's letter in the beginning of this issue, the undergirding this is the idea that Trump is not the cause of a lot of this. He's a symptom of a lot of this. You couldn't have Trump without technological advancement. You couldn't have Trump without gerrymandering and hyperpartisanship and factionalization and demonization of the political other. Like, those are necessary prerequisites for where we are today.
Let's take a couple of calls. Phil in West Orange, New Jersey. Hi, Phil. You want to talk about Citizens United?
Yeah, I do. I think probably the greatest threat to our democracy absolutely was the passage of Citizens United. When you talk about hyperpartisanism is being fueled by incredibly excessive amounts of dark money. Now, very fortunately, it appears that the folks behind some of that dark money now are going to have to step into the light, and that's a good thing. But at the end of the day, when it comes to the way in which our country has been divided, it is not purely on ideology for ideology's sake. It's behind a very specific kind of economic agenda. It's being fueled by huge amounts of money. And those folks that we have in Congress now, who are supposed to be representing us, the individual citizens of the United States, and working for the good of the people of the United States, are working for the good of the folks that continue to fund them to remain in office. The majority of the time that they spend, and in fact, I remember very specifically seeing an interview with Al Franken where he talks about 70% of his time was spent, once he arrived in the Senate, fundraising. This is ridiculous. This is not anything close to what was envisioned in terms of representation in this country. And I think that it's until we have the wherewithal to be able to push forward in terms of campaign finance reform, we are going to continue in what is really potentially a death spiral as far as democracy in this country.
Phil, thanks for calling. Jeffrey, does he have a point? Did money mess up democracy?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I was thinking, as he was talking, I was thinking about money and its relationship to technology. Remember, when did campaigns become really expensive to wage? The advent of television, right? When politicians
buying
started
ads, right.
Buying ads. I mean, that caused the desperate need on the part of candidates to go into this arms race, essentially, right? And spend 50, 60, 70% of the time raising money just to get on the air so they can beat the other guy who was already going up on the air. It's become a terrible and terrifying part of politics. This is, again, not to belabor this point, but we tend to be able to invent technologies, new and exciting technologies, before we know quite how to use them. And that's another example, I think, of a downstream consequence that we couldn't, that people at the time didn't envision.
You've been listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We're talking with Jeffrey Goldberg, editor-in-chief of The Atlantic. We'll have more with Jeffrey in a moment. We'll also take your calls on this question: is democracy dying? That number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. And later this hour, WNYC's Kate Hines is coming by to talk trash, New York City garbage, that is. Have you ever wondered why we put our bags on the street? Kate will tell us more as part of our weekly series, Living Here with Kate. This is All of It on WNYC. We'll be right back after the break. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and we are back with Jeffrey Goldberg, editor-in-chief of The Atlantic. The cover of The Atlantic, the October issue, asks this question: is democracy dying? If you'd like to weigh in, the number's 212-433-9692. Jeffrey, I want to run something by you. Someone, and I wish I could remember, someone smart I was talking to described America, the United States, as being in its adolescence, being sort of a pimply-faced adolescence where everything is right and wrong, black and white, good and bad, I'm going to do what I want to do, and that our politics is reflecting that kind of immaturity, and that other countries, they have systems where there are many parties, and when someone wins, then you have to get along with the other parties. What did you discover? What did you write about in the magazine in terms of where America is now versus the way other countries are expressing their democracy or what they've been through?
Yeah. I mean, I hope we're in our adolescence rather than our, you know, declining years. I mean, we're a youngish country, but a very, very old democracy. We're actually a very mature democracy. Nobody would have said that 4 years ago in the Obama administration when you had one of the most, I'm not commenting now on President Obama's policies. I'm just saying when you had a mature, self-restrained, dignified president, I don't think anybody would have necessarily felt that exact same way. Look, I don't agree with the premise. We have a wonderful article in this issue by Ann Applebaum, who's a Pulitzer Prize winner, a great scholar of communism, who talks about the retrenchment of democracy or the reversals democracy is facing in Eastern Europe, 25 years or so after the demise of communism. And what she found in Poland and Hungary and elsewhere, you know, some of the same disturbing trends, that democracy is not the natural state of humankind, that we do tend toward, or many people tend toward authoritarian tendencies or impulses as a way of solving their problems. I don't think there's really many places on the planet right now that you could look at and say, well, there's a country that's handling in a mature and interesting way its democratic challenge. I mean, we are not, to go back to Obama, you know, he frequently would quote the Martin Luther King line, the arc of history, the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And I think what we've seen over the last few years in the United States, but in a lot of other places as well, is the arc is not necessarily bending in some kind of smooth, inevitable way toward any particular outcome.
If we're talking about the idea of democracy dying, what does this mean for the pool of candidates who are running for our offices?
You know, it's one of the most amazing features of American political life, and I take this as a very huge positive for America, is that again and again, most rational people would look at what running for office, especially national office, federal office, governors, they look at what that's like and think, no, not for me, no thank you. But we seem to regenerate all the time, and we seem to get very, very good people to consider lives of public service. And it is punishing, but I am not I'm not a pessimist on that front. I still think that there are so many people across the political spectrum who want to participate and have something good to say, useful to say, and are engaged in useful behaviors, let's say. So I'm not I'm not worried. I don't think anything is inevitable, and that's part of the reason we need to be having serious discussions about the state of our democracy. Nothing is inevitable. You cannot put democracy on autopilot and expect that it's going to just keep working as it works forever, which means that people have to get engaged and have to get involved on the smallest level to the highest federal offices in the land and actually nurture this thing, because it is not necessarily the natural state of humankind.
Let's talk to Nick. He's from Monroe, New Jersey. Hi, Nick. You want to weigh in on what the current president has done?
Yeah, this is Nick. I just like to kind of suggest that what Trump has done here, as much of a disruptor as he is, he's got all of us reexamining democracy in many of its aspects, and I think that's a good thing. And my concern about destroying democracy is kind of founded on what I thought the founding fathers founded the country on, the Constitution, and that is a well-informed citizenry that goes to the polls. And yes, while they were very much concerned and did really enable direct democracy as opposed to representative, I find today the real threat to democracy is people going to the polls who are so very uninformed about what the issues are, to the point where I know from direct experience with people at the polls, when people start asking, you know, who's the person who is of this particular identification? Well, I want to vote for, but I don't know his name. So I'm really concerned. And there was, you might recall, a dynamic referred to as epistocracy. And I kind of support that and would like to see, you know, some evidence of you're informed about the policies and the people before you pull that lever in the voting box. Thank you.
Nick, thanks for weighing in. So Nick is talking about the low information, or he actually talking about the no information voter. Mm. So Jeffrey, but you know, there's been misinformation. We talked about Twitter and Facebook spreading misinformation, people believing it. But there was misinformation about the Vietnam War, about weapons of mass destruction. Remember the Jessica Lynch story that we were all sold. Mm-hmm. So what's so new about this era of misinformation?
Well, one of the things that's new about this era of misinformation is that you have a president who, let's just stipulate for discussion's sake that all presidents lie, all politicians lie. You have a situation now in which you have a president who refuses to be corrected in his untruths. When there are empirical facts that disprove things that he says, he just plows on ahead and pivots and blames the news media for spreading lies. But there is such a thing as empirical truth, observable truth, and this president is unusually insensitive to that reality. And that, of course, encourages bad actors in this country and other places to think that, okay, the restraints are off. We can now say whatever we want people to believe without regard to actual fact checking, without regard to what it is that we see, and I would argue that the president is as much a role model as he is executive and head of one of the branches of government. If the president shows some respect for the idea that there are truths that are sometimes inconvenient for political reasons, but that these things are observably true, then you have to deal within that reality. We now have a president who regularly steps outside that reality.
But isn't that our responsibility as citizens to make sure that we are informed? Are we responsible for democracy dying because we're not taking care of it?
Everyone is responsible for democracy dying, but I think our elected leaders are the people we designate to nurture the institutions and protect and defend the norms of democratic behavior. Obviously, each individual citizen has a responsibility, and the caller is exactly right. And this is a nonpartisan observation. Most people don't know enough about what's going on in the world around them and how the government affects their lives and America's role in the world and all the rest. Fixing that is the work of a lifetime.
All right, let's take a listen to some of our callers. We've got Bruce in Brewster, New York. Hi, Bruce. What did you want to add?
How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
I wonder, in listening to this program, and I have wondered for some time, whether it's not what I like to call the fat and happy syndrome combined with a loss of a national identity that creates the impression and possibly the fact that democracy in the United States is in danger. I'd be curious to hear what you think about that.
What do you think, Jeffrey?
Go on a little bit, because I'm not 100% sure I understand.
Well, by fat and happy syndrome, what I mean is most people in America have enough to eat. They have a nice place to live. They have a car. They have a job. They're not hurting. They have enough money.
Right. This is not the
and
Great Depression.
So the idea of being involved in government is not something that's terribly important to them because there's no danger.
That is interesting.
In terms of national identity, I think that there was a time in this country, most recently I think it was the election of 1862, when 90% of the registered American voting population actually voted. 90%.
Right.
They did that because they had a strong sense of the identity of the country and the important issues that faced us.
Right.
Thank you, Bruce.
We are not in that consciousness today.
Right. No, there is an interesting argument to be made. The economist Tyler Cowen, I'm going to paraphrase an argument he made. Somebody asked him, I think, once, you know, why is America never revolutionary? Why are Americans never revolutionary? And he said, look, there's enough cheap calories in this country. There's enough entertainment. Very few people are starving. I'm just paraphrasing an argument that the level of desperation is in order to be in a pre-revolutionary state or even to be in a state of hyper-political engagement, you have to have a little bit more desperation. I can't disagree with your analysis. I find it a little bit sad, obviously, because but maybe this is the way we cycle. Maybe history isn't an arrow flying ever forward, but it's a cycle. It's a circle, and we neglect our institutions and our democracy to the point where they actually begin to break, and then we wake up, and then try to fix them again. And that just humans cycle through history in this way, rather than, let's say, learning from some of the mistakes of these past cycles.
I think we have time for one more caller. Let's bring in Sheila from Poughkeepsie. Sheila, do you feel overwhelmed by all of the election news and all of the political news?
No, I'm not overwhelmed at all. In fact, I'd like to talk first. I have 3 points, and I want to say something about the previous caller and 1862 and 90% of the vote. Who voted in 1862? Not women, not slaves, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very small population of primarily landed or property owners.
You go, Sheila.
Okay, so that's one point, but that brings me to the numbing quality of the election cycle, particularly for federal and state offices, and the huge amount of money that's required to seek such office. It goes on forever, and people after a while just sort of, I think, shut it out, because you keep hearing the same thing over and over on NPR and NYC and so on and so forth. And after a while, the election comes and goes. And I've run for office, and I've talked to people the day after I got elected or didn't get elected, and they say, oh, I'm going to vote for you. And I have the only thing that brings me to my third point, which is about civic life and our failure to educate people. We don't know enough about our civic institutions, about the forms of governance we have, about how people get on the ballot, about what parties do, or how you get to be part of the ruling group in a party. So unless we restore to our educational institutions valid and engaging civic education, I do fear for democracy, but I'm hopeful because there are obvious solutions, and I'll listen to your response to my my diatribe.
Sheila, thank you for that. Was hardly a diatribe.
That was
Sheila.
A very refined diatribe. I think that was no diatribe at all. I mean, there's nothing really there to disagree with. I think one of the themes that's emerged in these calls from your very thoughtful callers is this. Is the cyclical nature of this question, and which goes to this point about democracy itself? That it did we lose them?
We're here. No, you're here. You're here, Jeff. Go ahead. Maybe Jeff believes we've lost him. Let's check in, see if the magic machine can bring Jeffrey back. If not, you know what? We're going to wrap there. I think we've lost Jeffrey, which is unfortunate. I could talk to Jeff all day long. I'm sure I will be able to get him back again. That was Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic. The cover of their October issue asked the important question, is democracy dying? Stay with us. We'll be back with more of all of it on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. This is All of It on WNYC, and it's time for Living Here with Kate. It's the time of the show when we carve out to talk about the shared experience of being a New Yorker. And you've heard me say All of It is about culture and the culture, and certainly living here in New York is its own cultural experience. WNYC's Kate Hines is here. She's a planning editor in the station's award-winning newsroom. And Kate, this week, you want to talk garbage.
I do. You're building up as like a cultural experience. And I want to talk about how I'm walking over piles of garbage on my way to the subway.
So other big cities don't appear to have the same amount of garbage on the streets as we do. And I was sharing with you earlier that a friend's daughter came from Portland and was horrified that mm-hmm. we put our garbage on the sidewalk. She said, what is this? So why is it such a common occurrence in New York?
Well, first I want to be a little bit defensive and point out that New York City, and especially Manhattan, has a higher population density than any other place in the United States, and even worldwide in many cases. So there is that. There are a lot of us living here. But the second thing is, and I need to take it back in history a little bit, a lot of this goes back to something called the Commissioner's Plan of 1811, which lays out the street grid for most of Manhattan, from somewhere like above Houston and south of 155th Street. And what that grid does is not make room for alleys, which other cities have a lot of, places like Chicago, Los Angeles. And there are some alleys in Manhattan and in the other boroughs, but we don't have alleys. We decided that we wanted to maximize residential living space and density, even back in 1811. So that left us with no other place to put it but the streets. And you go back in time and you look at those pictures that Jacob Riis took, mm-hmm. and you see garbage all over the place, even back in the day, 100 plus years ago.
So, but when you hear people talk about the garbage, I know I just got a puppy. And, and when I walk the puppy, the garbage is it's his joy. It's the bane of my existence because he won't walk down the street. Now, the sanitation department has to be aware of the fact that people don't really like to see garbage on the street, and because it attracts vermin, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Well, that's why we have such great rats here in New York. I mean, how else would we do it? You know, and the thing that I think is interesting is it seems to be getting worse. Today is recycling day in my neighborhood, and the amount of cardboard boxes that are put out on the street literally impedes the flow of pedestrian foot traffic. So I have been, you know, talking to people about this. This has been an issue for, you know, decades and decades. I'm hardly the first person to notice this and talk about it. But I spoke to Christine Berthe. She is on the Transportation Committee of Community Board 4. This is a very dense neighborhood, Manhattan's West mm-hmm. Side, Hell's Kitchen, Clinton, parts of Chelsea. And I asked her, you know, what sort of things are you thinking about? Like, what do you notice when you get down the street? And how do you think we could get away from just putting piles of garbage on city sidewalks? And this is what she said.
Reserve some space on the parking lane for bins. And you would have some bins, and you can take your bins and put them in that reserve spot, or multiple reserve spot, obviously.
She says, you know, this is something that a lot of other cities do. Instead of piling the garbage on the street, on the sidewalk, you put it in the street. You put dedicated bins in parking spaces. Now, of course, anytime you talk about,
oh, getting rid of people's parking, Kate.
It's like, I wish I had a button that I could just be like, roo. She's talking about parking spaces.
You have to be on the front lines on that on your own, honey. Right. I wouldn't go there.
And when I talked about this with sanitation, they weren't ready to go there either. So I think this is like, we are way, you know, it's early to talk about it, but it's something to think about.
You talked about the density of New York. There are other cities around the globe that are as dense, if more and not more dense than New York. What do they do?
One of my favorites, and there's a million things. It's so fascinating because it is so cultural. How you handle garbage tells you a lot about that city. My colleague Richard Ye, who is from Taiwan, posted a video to his Instagram account, and I'll tweet it after this because it's so fabulous, of how the city of Taichung, which is where he's from, mm-hmm. handles garbage. First, I need to just play the soundtrack to that. That's a little garbage truck. It's not like the garbage truck we think of. It's a smaller garbage truck just making its way down the street. Playing.
Sounds like Mr. Softy.
It is, but it's not the ice cream man. People are coming out of their homes and businesses. It's about 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, and carrying bags of not only garbage, but recycling and composting as well, you know, waiting their turn to get it in the truck. There are no garbage cans. Richard says the goal is to not let garbage touch the street of the city. You carry it from your home and put it in the back of the truck.
That would be a cultural shift.
That would be a huge cultural shift. Now, to be fair, you know, I did a little Googling, and according to Google, the population density in Taichung is about 1,600 people per square mile. Manhattan is closer to 70,000 people per square mile. But it doesn't mean we can't think about garbage a little differently.
Are there quick fixes that we could think about?
Beyond, you know, there are places in Manhattan that do put garbage on the street. Christine Berthe was talking about Manhattan Plaza, which is a huge apartment complex over on 42nd Street that manages to compact the garbage in their building, and then they put it in dumpsters on the street. When I talked to the sanitation department and said, what could be coming down the road? They're like, we want to get to you before you throw the garbage away. We want building designers and architect and building managers to think about how to store it in the building and how to make how you think about garbage different before it even hits your personal garbage can. So they're trying to sort of take it at the root cause. When I asked Christine Berthe, is there some sort of, you know, is there a groundswell of support for the idea of radically rethinking how New Yorkers take out their garbage? Like, where's the movement? Are people, you know, in the streets fighting for more choices? This is what she said.
Yeah, you and I. We are a movement. That's it.
So early stages.
And one sense, I do want to say, I think it's really great that New Yorkers are so invested in recycling as much as they are. You talked about the cardboard boxes.
Right.
That's a huge jump from when I was a kid and people used to just throw everything together. So there is a silver lining to having that in your way.
It is. But I don't think New York City's recycling rates are that great. And I think they may even still be depressed below the rate that they were when Bloomberg canceled the paper and glass recycling in the 90s to save money for the city. That's the big fear. Like once you take a step back, it takes a long time. I might be wrong about that. I need to check it. But you know,
I just threw that one at you, curveball. Sorry.
No, it's fine. If I don't know it all, look it up. But I think we do good. I think we could do a lot better. And you know, not all neighborhoods even compost. This is something that, you know, the city's been trying to get off the ground.
Oh, that's a whole other living here with Kate, composting.
Yeah, I don't do it. But my mother does. Do I get credit for that?
We'll bring Mom on. Kate, thank you so much for joining us. We'll see what you bring to us next week.
Thank you.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We'll be right back. Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. It's not often that you get to see films by the likes of Jean-Luc Godard, Chantal Ackerman, and Jean Rouch under one roof, let alone programmed as part of the same series. But this is precisely the opportunity you have now through the end of the month at Metrograph, a movie theater on the border of the Lower East Side in Chinatown. Metrograph opened its doors over more than 2 years ago and offers the rare treat of seeing seminal films in their original 35 and 16 millimeter formats. This month, Metrograph is hosting a series of films in honor of Icarus Films called Icarus Films at 40. The screening celebrates the 40th anniversary of Icarus Films, a distribution company that prioritizes documentary films that offer alternative to standard historical narratives. Here to discuss the series are Icarus Films president Jonathan Miller and the artistic and programming director at Metrograph, Jacob Perlin. Thanks so much for coming into the studio today.
Sure, thanks for having us.
Jonathan, the origin story of Icarus Films, it starts in 1978, is that correct? You were a
yes.
College student at NYU?
Well,
sort of.
I was sort of out of college.
Okay.
We were out of college.
So what was the original intent when you first started Icarus Films, and how did it start?
I did not start the company. This company was started by a classmate of mine named Ilan Ziv,
right.
And I worked with him at that time, and he set it up because we had a lot of films from the Middle East, which had been shown in a festival at the Bleecker Street Cinema in New York in 77, and we didn't have any jobs, and we thought these were films that needed to be seen by a wider audience. They dealt with the political issues in the Middle East, like today.
Mm-hmm.
And so the beginning of the company was booking these films into theaters and film societies around the country outside of New York. And this was right before the Iranian Revolution. We had a feature film by at the time and one of the most important Iranian directors, Darius Mirzoui. And we had a documentary from Germany, which sort of predicted the revolution.
Wow.
So those films were the first ones that sort of got us out there.
When you originally started the company and you were just getting it off the ground, what was your goal? And then how has that changed, or maybe not changed, over the past 40 years as you look back?
Well, the goal was just to get the films seen as
just
widely as
possible. Just let people see
them, yes. The films we distributed had a political line. Mm-hmm. I mean, the point was to make an intervention in the cultural and political dialogue of the time. Shortly after we started distributing films about Central America and the American interventions in El Salvador and Nicaragua. And from there, we kept expanding the areas of films that we distributed. And over time, we got more sort of auteur-type, larger creative documentaries, like the films by Chris Marker or Chantal Ackerman. So the collection has continuously broadened as well as deepened in the areas that we are known for.
I want to follow up on with Chris Marker. He was an enigmatic filmmaker. Sometimes people even know that was really his name, right? That was sort of
incredible. Well, wasn't his legal name.
Legal name. How did you work? Did you work with him? Did you work with representatives?
Well, both. I mean, it depended. He did not sell his films himself, so he worked with producers, and the producers worked with sales agents. So to acquire the rights to the films, one had to work with other people. But most of the films we get are people that he had longstanding relationships with, the producer and the producer's companies. He worked a lot with two particular companies in Paris, and we have quite a few films from those companies. And interestingly, they're both now owned and run by the daughters of the fathers who produced the films with Chris. Once I started working with, interested in getting his films and releasing his films, then yes, I worked with Chris. We made an English version of one of his films. He always wanted to be involved in the design of the sleeves and the posters. He, wanted to know what was going on. He didn't want to do interviews, although once at the end he almost agreed to do one, but we weren't happy with the conditions, so we didn't do it. So I would see him when I went to Paris, and he would want to be involved in the presentation, how his films were presented and talked about.
That's understandable, of course. Jake, let's bring you into the conversation. How did the idea for these screenings come about?
Well, the anniversary was coming up, and I've known about Icarus forever. You know, before any type of professional programming life, just as a cinephile, these are films that I've been exposed to as long as I can remember. And then it just seemed like a chance to dig really deep into the catalog. I think we were showing over 50 films, but I mean, that was even like a considerably pared down list of how much I wanted to do. I actually just went through it web page by web page. And just tried to, I was just struck by all these films that had meant something to me over my sort of film going life, you know, major figures like Ackerman and Marker. But mm-hmm. then I realized that so much of what I know about specific historical incidents, as John mentioned, you know, North American intervention in South and Central America, African liberation struggles, came from these movies. It seemed like an opportunity to remind the audience, and a younger audience that comes to Metrograph, of these really, really important, relatively recent historical events that in a lot of ways have just sort of been forgotten about by a lot of people. You know, John mentioned El Salvador and Nicaragua, but liberation struggles all across the world, and the sense of internationalism which used to unify these movements has been forgotten. So it's thrilling to be able to present these films again. And just, I think it's important to be reminded periodically, sort of refresh the tree of knowledge in terms of a lot of things that have happened in the name of the American people in the last 100 years and longer than that. And it's recent history. It's amazing stuff from the 80s that I grew up. It was very much part of my childhood. Seems to have disappeared. And, you know, I think we were talking about this the other day. There was a stuff about Ortega still in the news. This stuff is constantly to be revisited, rethought about. And Icarus, by keeping these films in circulation, and then to some lesser extent my just being able to be in a position to exhibit them, just keeps it out there. And that's sort of the goal.
It's sort of interesting that you talked about your demographic, maybe not even knowing, not you can revisit and remember. Some people are young enough not to ever experience this, or possibly, which is sort of scary, not even have learned about it in school.
Well, I think it probably wasn't thought about. I mean, mm-hmm. I think certain aspects of American history certainly are, but in terms of like imperialist wars and other things like that, that's not stuff that's certainly being taught. So for someone to learn about it, it is through seeing these films. And it's very, very simple things. I mean, if you don't see a film about Senegal or Mozambique, you don't know who the historical figures are. You might not even know what the spoken language of those countries are. So much of what I've learned about the world has come through being an avid cinephile. So these films are sort of like a, you know, an introductory course or a refresher in like, in the history of recent world, particularly around liberation struggles and democratic movements.
So what are some of the unifying themes as you started to put the program together and started to assemble it? You talked about the difficulty of making choices. There's so much to pick from. You picked just over 50 films. How did you decide what palette to put forward?
Well, the films sort of form natural connections. Last night we did a program, a film called Taking Back Detroit and a film called Finally Got the News. You know, these are community organizing films around the auto industry in Michigan. This sort of forms a natural connection. But pairing a film...
Just to interject.
Yeah, dive in. Please.
They're also tell a history which... of Michigan and of Detroit and of the auto industry and of the working class and of African Americans, which is not known really today.
And it's interesting considering that Detroit is the city that people are looking at right now as being going
through
a renaissance.
This is the prehistory of that.
Yeah. What do you think from that history? I'm going to dive in because I find this interesting, that you think is getting forgotten as we talk about Detroit being this city having a rebirth.
What's being forgotten about Detroit?
Yeah, about that whole past
history. Well, that sort of was one of the centers of the American labor movement and the history of American technology and the American working class and disenfranchised African-American communities and the relationship between them and unions and workers and the exodus of American manufacturing from the Midwest. I mean, the reason why Detroit is being rebuilt is because all of the auto industry, most of the auto industry, has left. And the after effects of that and of the urban upheavals of the 60s and 70s is still not resolved. But people now who are 30 or 40 or 20 they certainly did not study that as far as I know.
Jake, can you offer another?
No, yeah, rewatching the films last night. I mean, just to be clear, these films, in the case of Taking Back Detroit, this takes place in the early 80s, you know? So in the film, they're talking about rebuilding Detroit, a sort of renaissance in the downtown.
Well, they're also talking about democratic socialism.
Yes, that is
absolutely. Oh, wow.
Yeah, because the film is about a socialist candidate being elected to the Detroit City Council.
I guess.
Prescient.
And as a judge.
But to hear sort of these things that are being discussed then and sort of all these years later still being discussed, I think a lot of what's been great about seeing these films is to see about these trends or cycles that people speaking about them in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and we're sort of at a similar point. So you're being introduced, in a lot of cases the audience is being introduced to these issues, but for people like myself who may have had some pre-knowledge to it, I'm also getting to sort of rethink about it and see what has changed in the interim since these films were made.
We've got about a minute left, and I know this is going on through the end of September. Can you give us a little bit of preview of something people might want to check out, a personal recommendation of what's on the menu for the next few days?
I don't really remember what's being shown this week.
This weekend
Jake
we have
answer that.
Well, this week we have the Mata Mata and Pili Pili film,
right.
And we have a film by Julie Gustafson, Casting the First Stone, a film by Lynn Sachs, Investigation of a Flame. Do you want to say something about some unifying things of those?
Well, they're quite different. The Mata Mata film is made from fiction film shot in the Congo in the 20s by Belgian missionary, and
well, that's a whole history as well.
Right, you could make a film about that. Well, the film is actually a film about the film, so
everything that the audience comes to see will be great.
That was quite a pitch, Jacob. You're a professional. Jacob Perler from Metrograph, Jonathan Miller from Icarus Films. Thank you so much for joining us on All of It on WNYC.
Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Brennan Center for Justice, presenting The Failed Experiment of Mass Incarceration. This virtual event on Wednesday, April 17th at 3 p.m. will feature criminal justice advocates and contributors to the new book, Excessive Punishment: How the Justice System Creates Mass Incarceration. They will discuss why the American approach to criminal justice is so punitive and how reforms would prioritize human dignity and restoration over retribution. Find more information and register for this event at brennancenter.org/events.